Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Amico, and today we're joined by Madison Moore, author of the new book, Fabulous, The Rise of the Beautiful Eccentric. The book is published by Yale University Press. As Madison makes clear at the beginning of his book, it's not a history of the idea of fabulousness or any kind of set understanding and display of the fabulous, because the fabulous is, by definition, ephemeral, able to appear in any place, at any time, by anybody, and always on the move. Of course, there are specific communities of people who embrace fabulousness and other communities that actively police it. But the primary sites where it is most highly valued and expressed are physical spaces, including the site of the body itself. And so Madison offers a chapter on how to work a look, as well as one on the club scene, particularly the line to get into the club, and another chapter on the catwalk. Most important is Madison's firsthand involvement in these sites of fabulousness. He is a participant and organizer in and of the worlds that he then not merely, quote, explains, but actively demonstrates in his scholarship and life. This gives the book and his work more broadly real ethical stakes. Madison Moore is a DJ, cultural critic, and assistant professor of gender, sexuality, and women's studies. He's also creative director and resident DJ at Opulence, an art collective and queer techno party. And he has home bases in New York, London, and Berlin. Madison, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Now, I have to say that Madison and I both received PhDs from the American Studies program at Yale University. So, Madison, tell us how this book, this project of fabulousness, emerged and diverged out of your time in that academic department. Where did this book come from?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. I'm so excited to be in this exchange and talk about the ideas around the book. It's interesting that I've just had my 36th birthday. And so I would say that I've been writing this book for 36 years. And that sort of... when I, you know, the kind of background that informs the book really is my upbringing by, you know, growing up in Ferguson, Missouri, in a solidly working class family where we didn't have much, but we always looked good, and where sort of style was a premium, and my grandmother wouldn't let us out of the house unless we were, like, presentable, which of course has a whole history, around, like, Black respectability politics and whatnot. So for me, like, these ideas about style and self-presentation and creating space on your own terms were brewing already when I was 5 and 10 and at church and, hanging out with my, at family barbecues or whatever, and seeing how much joy the women in my family took and the people in my family took in kind of getting dressed up. So when I got to Yale, I knew that I was already interested in questions of fashion. And, I knew that Valerie Steele, who got her PhD in history at Yale, who was the chief curator of the museum at FIT in New York. I was like, okay, well, that's like, there's a lineage there. You know, someone, there's already people thinking about fashion in that space. So, you know, I think this is, there's a lot of different pieces. I mean, when I was working with Joe Roach, who was really one of my early champions and who was really helped me shape the work. I remember we had a meeting in my early days in the program, and he said, "What do you want to work on?" And I said, "Well, I don't really know." And so he said, "What do you like to do in your spare time?" And I said, "Well, I like shopping, reading fashion magazines, and going to clubs." And he said, "Well, why don't you study that?" And I was like, "Those aren't real topics. What do you mean? I can't study that stuff. That's not real, you know." And so, in fact, like my whole kind of time at Yale was actually learning how to fuse the bodily knowledge that I already had, as I've said, you know, that I grew up thinking about these questions already, and then learning how to tie that to asking questions around that and tying that into histories, other histories, you know, during my time kind of in the program.
Right.
It's a really roundabout answer, but yeah, there you go.
Well, and it speaks to the power of finding the right advisor to show you, to say that your way is okay.
Yeah.
And your way is a way that is intertwined with practice. And so I want you to talk a little bit about what you call the theory of fabulousness as a practice. And the book references, you know, theorists that people may or may not know, but in the end, it doesn't really matter who you're referencing. It actually matters. Your experience itself is what matters, your own history. And so I'm wondering what that means, that your practice, your life of fabulousness or moments of it is the theory, is knowledge, tells us something.
Well, you know, I think that for me, you know, it's a good question, because I remember being so frustrated when I was sort of in seminars, you know, and in school, and even till now, you know, writing, you know, articles for publication in journals, academic journals, where folks say, "Oh, your writing style is too journalistic, or it's too personal, or it's not sort of scholarly enough." And, you know,
it's too fabulous.
Oh, I wasn't going to say that. Thank you for saying it. but no, that like there's basically that there's something wrong, right, with being able to be a bit creative and being a bit, you know, bringing some sort of effervescence and kind of a bit of, personality to scholarly writing. I think that there's such a way that scholarly writing can often be really in the service of folks who have PhDs. And I knew that I wanted to write a book that would actually hopefully be read, that could sort of hopefully be taught and read in university spaces, but then also more importantly for me, read by a general interest audience, by folks who haven't gone through sort of Ivy League institutions or any institutions, who can pick up the book and they can read the stories and resonate with them. The stories can resonate with them, and that they can, maybe they've not heard about, you know, sort of bell hooks or Francesco Royster, but now they know about them. Do you know? And for
right.
me, that's the bigger mission. I would say that like I had such resistance in sort of owning my own writing, you know, and owning that it's okay to sort of be experimental and playful as I try to be in my work. And that's another mode sort of theory. So yeah, when I say that it's like, you know, theory, you know, it's theory from the streets and all this kind of stuff, it's like, cause it has real time stakes. There's real things at stake.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, playful is an interesting word, that your writing could be playful. And that is what, people may, especially in the academy, police, and it's a question of joy and basically not being able to share in their own joy and your joy. And we're going to get back to that, because you talk a lot about the connection between fabulousness and joy, and especially the gift of joy through fabulousness. But let's think about the underside, I guess, of joy, for lack of a better word. You have a sentence at the beginning, and this speaks to the question of a larger audience and the real ethical stakes. You write, quote, "You can't understand fabulousness unless you get that it emerges from trauma, duress, exclusion, exhaustion, and depression. And that in some ways, being fabulous is the only thing that can get us out of the bed in the morning.
Mm-hmm. End quote.
Mm-hmm. So good morning to you in London.
Yes.
And I think that's a wonderful statement because it's broad, but it's very clear. And as you say, it opens up onto any number of people identifying where they may find themselves in terms of the question of fabulousness. So what does that mean that it emerges from trauma?
Yeah. You know, I think that for me, this isn't the sort of first book that's about, you know, style and questions of glamour and spectacle, you know? But what I realized when I was kind of doing my kind of work and research is that so many of the books are focusing on the one hand, on Hollywood, and on celebrities and by extension, white people, white women, especially. It was frustrating to me that there was almost, at least in what I could find, not very much conversation around style politics or self-presentation in a kind of glamorous way, and also thinking about race and queerness and gender and all these things. And so that was one part of the equation. The other part of it is that in doing the interviews that I've done for the book, and also thinking about my own experience with, you know, kind of style and moving through social space, is that it comes from the traumatic spaces where you think that, you know, you actually decide to choose you instead of choosing the systems and norms that oppress us every day, if that makes sense. So I think I was trying to marry, on the one hand, or try to figure out how to talk about style and fabulousness, particularly with a queer and of color and non-binary lens, while also thinking about, what are the stakes and how do people circulate? It isn't just about, you know, getting all dressed up, you know, it's about getting dressed up maybe sometimes, but then also sometimes feeling like you can't because the pressures are so strong. And you know that, like, if you are in your favorite look or whatever, or even a lipstick or whatever it is, your thing is, you know, that you might go outside to get a sandwich and you could be verbally harassed. You could be physically harassed. You yourself could be afraid and, you know, just feel the trauma of other people staring at you or pointing at you or making it get known that you are sort of, something that they think should be sort of gawked at. And these are all traumatic things. And so my interest in fabulousness is people, you know, there's a turning point. People basically decide to give up on these norms and embrace themselves on their own terms. And what I like to think of as a sort of escape hatch or plan B from, you know, or out of kind of normativity. You know, I think about how I think about my own sort of grinder profile pic or whatever dating app. Sometimes it's like, okay, do I use the lipstick one or do I use the more mask presenting one? And why do I have to even decide? You know, or even just yesterday I've had, there was someone who came, I had a party at my house and someone told me that they've just recently come out as non-binary and they are, they were really afraid, but felt so excited to be in this space. And, you know, even at the party that I do, you know, people always, my opulence party, you know, people always say that they're so excited to have this space where they can just sort of breathe. Do you know what I mean? Without having the sort of eye of being policed around all the time.
Right. So there are these spaces like the parties that you host or certain clubs that provide a community. But also, as you were saying, most people can't stay in those spaces all day and night, and they have to go get a sandwich or they have to go to the store. And yet they still can be fabulous. They still have style, and yet it is risky. It's not a completely safe way of being, except of course the risk opens up onto life and joy and all these other things. I mean, I guess just to get this out of the way, can we just talk about the difference between style and say fashion or trends? Because it seems like style is something that is risky, is dangerous, is personal, can happen in bursts and moments, and fashion or trend is something that you fit into that is actually not that risky.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that, like, I would say that, you know, sort of fashion and kind of trends are, as you say, more like what's kind of the vibe, what's kind of, you know, popping off right now, sort of in terms of popular culture or kind of visual culture, what the celebrities are doing or whatever, which means it's tied more to industry and it's tied more to kind of, I would say, flows of capital in ways. Like, it's like what H&M or what Vogue says is in or whatever. And I think that style, real style, is being, figuring out what you want to be or not knowing even what that is and playing with that kind of on your own terms, whatever. So today it might be this, but next week it could be completely something else. So for me, style is more personalized and it's more reflecting kind of like how you imagine yourself today. Whereas I think trends and fashion are much more tied to industry and much more sort of tied to what the high street says you should be wearing, if that makes sense.
Right. And style is an invitation for others to play, I would argue, right? I mean, it's immediately social. And although it invites easily denigration or even violence, it also invites play.
I mean, it's a call and response, I think. You know, I mean, there have been so many times where I've been like, oh my God, girl, you look cute with that lipstick. Let me put on some lipstick like that, you know, or whatever, you know, or like, in fact, it's in hanging out with a sort of crew of, you know, queer POC in London over the years that I have been like, oh, I kind of like lipstick. Let me see how this works for me. And so now I've been wearing like this sort of blue lipstick. And it's because, again, as you say, and as it is, style is social and it's a call and response. So, and it might be that, you know, you might see someone on the tube and that you really like their haircut and maybe challenges you to think about how you want to be, you know, or pushes you to think, well, I can't really, you know, a key example is I've got these shoes. I think they're photographed in the book. They're these black and white spiked shoes with like a heelless kind of wedge, and they look very space age, very alien. They're very sickening. But every time people see them, they're like, oh, I could never wear those. I could never wear them. And it's like, well, why not? Who says you couldn't wear them? And yesterday at this party that I was speaking of, you know, I had all my heels downstairs and everyone was sort of trying them on and kind of, you know, feeling themselves in them. And I actually ended up giving away one of my pair to someone who I felt really needed it and really needed them to sort of like, help them kind of come into who they would like to be. Do you know what I mean?
Right. I mean, that's just back to the point about fabulousness as a gift. Literally, you gave that which someone felt joy in wearing or in being with. You then actualize that and said, you can take it, it's yours.
Yeah.
The fabulousness as much as the shoe.
Yeah, yes, yes. it's an all-in-one package, darling. It was just such a moment of joy for me to see this person in the shoes and how much they were like coming into themselves and like they just like it was a cute look, you know? And what I'm learning in how the book is sort of circulating, especially on social media, is, you know, people have been sending me beautiful selfies of them getting the book in the mail, or like putting on a look and then posing with the book, you know, and these are people that I don't know, you know, they're just people on Instagram who tag me and I end up seeing the post, you know what I mean? And so for me, this is like, so important that it's like circulating precisely that way, you know, that it's like hopefully will be instructional in, you know, queer studies courses and, you know, courses around kind of race and intersectionality and kind of pop culture, but also even more that like the girls are getting the book and they're feeling it, you know, it's like really speaking to them and helping them kind of reimagine how they want to circulate.
Right. And I think that it makes me think that those who denigrate or people who don't fit in, whose fabulousness is experienced as an affront to others, that the joke is ultimately on those people because it's a sign that they've lost something about themselves. And, you know, that's a feeling of joy. That's a feeling of happiness that they can't actually partake in not just someone else's happiness, but their own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think that applies to not just marginalized people, but all sorts of people who feel like they already fit into normative standards, that they are losing out as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one of the questions that someone asked once is, will this book make me fabulous? And for me, like, I'm less interested in that kind of self-help narrative and more interested in, like, if you read the book and if it allows you to see how sort of these systems oppress us and how you are policing yourself, and if you read the book and if it makes you kind of question those things and give up, then perhaps yes, you know, and if it allows you to sort of, you know, play with your identity and realize that identity isn't fixed and stable and you can be who you want at any moment. You know, understanding the risks of that as well. But choosing that kind of uncertain path rather than, you know, making yourself fit into this box that wasn't even constructed for you with you in mind in the first place.
Right. And that it doesn't have to be a lifelong decision that,
yes,
that being fabulous can happen at any moment. In small doses, in large amounts, whatever it means for you, right?
What
you throughout the book, one of the most persuasive parts for me was you're drawing attention to these moments that again appear in any time mm-hmm. on anybody. Mm-hmm. That it's not isolated to a particular group of people, but that it nonetheless still comes out of the question of if not being traumatized, at least hiding something about yourself or feeling that you can't express something about yourself.
Yes. You know, and I want to be clear that, you know, I don't think that, like everybody needs to be fabulous right now or sort of, you know, be excommunicated from society or whatever, but that, like, you know, living under these norms isn't helpful for anybody. and I think that, like, you know, embracing the uncharted path, embracing the kind of risky nature of, you know, choosing to be you on different terms. And also, you know, I mean, what I've also told people is, you know, as you step into yourself more, you know, it is also about surrounding yourself with community and folks who like also kind of get it. You know, I mean, I think that people often ask me in, you know, sort of public conversations about the book, you know, when did I decide that I was, you know, non-binary, or when did I sort of come out, or whenever these things. And, you know, as I've said, I've only started wearing like the lipstick, for instance, like 3 months ago, you know, and I've just turned 36. So, you know, but also at 15, I remember looking up to folks like Michael Jackson and Prince because they were able to be so expansive in kind of their gender and in their kind of in their blackness as well. So, I think it's a journey, and you always, you know, you shapeshift. And I think what I want is for people to understand that possibility of shapeshifting, and not necessarily being the same body all the time every day.
Right. And that happens in different ways or over time. So when you're younger and you can't get into the club, you still can look at Prince or listen to Prince. And you can read your book. And I don't mean that just because you're here talking to us about your book, but as you say, people are reading the book and taking pictures of it on Instagram. So mm-hmm. what is the power of social media, networking, technology, and the like for the expression of fabulousness, especially among younger people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really fascinating. I mean, I remember I think, you know, I also sort of grew up on the internet, and I remember being in chat rooms on gay.com, you know, talking to people, just trying to connect with anyone, you know, in my like Ferguson, in the basement, my basement room in Ferguson, Missouri, you know. Now the girls have YouTube and they have Instagram and they have, you know, they can type in, you know, non-binary or coming out in YouTube and like have like a whole series of videos of people, you know, showing that this is, well, first of all, that they're not alone. In addition to that, there are also, you know, selfie threads. So there are groups on Facebook that are private that are, you know, like queer non-binary, for instance, in London or whatever, or queer non-binary in Atlanta or wherever, let's say. And it's just like people asking advice about how they get through the day and how they kind of, you know, it's sort of a support network. But then also people will be like, I'm feeling a bit low, let's start a selfie thread. And then suddenly you'll just have 500 amazing people, you know, sending selfies of themselves. Some of them are like in looks, some of them are just being like, here's me right now at work, bored or whatever. But it is about, as it was when I was on gay.com and as it is now with Instagram and YouTube, it's about finding community and trying to feel like you're not alone in this. And I think for me, that's what's so exciting about, you know, what young people have access to today. I mean, speaking of the party that I had yesterday, I know we keep going back to that, but I'm a party girl. is, you know, there were these, so it was my birthday party, but then also there was like a big neighborhood party. And I live in a place where all of the sort of houses are connected. There's like a shared courtyard. And so at one point there were like, I would say 15, literally 15 or even 20 like kids who came over between, I would say, ages of like 8 and 15. Because, you know, they were so excited by all of us people in the house. We were, you know, sissies, you know, with heels and like all this. And they were just so, like, there were these two boys who I would say maybe were 8, 10, and they were desperate to try the heels on. And they had no, like, concept that it was, like, faux pas or forbidden or anything. They were like, oh my God, yes, these are amazing. I feel so confident in these. I feel so powerful in these. And to me, that was such a beautiful moment because, like, I don't know that when I was that age 30 years ago or whatever, 28 years ago, like, that I would have had that same sense of, oh, I can just do this thing, you know, and not feel right. Policed or sort of, you know. Well,
it sounds to me like you created a club type atmosphere in the courtyard and that it was a product, is a product of the energy and the people that gives others the permission to be themselves or
yeah.
Whatever word you want to use. And we'll talk more about clubs. I mean, just want to go back to the question of selfies and connecting through these communities online. You know, there's this ongoing critique of selfie culture and narcissism. Mm-hmm. But you make this really important point that it's actually different in terms of if you look at who is taking these pictures, why, and how they're using them to connect to other people.
Yes.
And so that it's a medium to shape, to control, to take control of one's own image.
Yes.
And that's the very opposite of the kind of narcissistic selfie culture that you know, mainstream media critique. So can you talk a little bit about that difference?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think, you know, one of the real eye-openers for me in thinking around this, you know, of course there's like, you know, kind of lines of thought like Christopher Lash thinking about narcissism. But then there's also for me the great Minha T. Pham, who writes In Asians Wear Clothes on the Internet, which is a book about, you know, style politics online, how Asian Americans present themselves on sort of precisely in selfies. And what she says is that basically, yeah, selfies are ways that people present themselves on it's like the right to be seen, basically, is what she says. And so for me, that was so powerful in thinking about fabulousness and sort of how these selfies circulate, you know, in these spaces, because it's like, I have the right to be, not only do I have the right to be me, but I have the right to be seen on my own terms. And yes, you know, selfies are carefully constructed. Not only do you take the image, but you put the filter on it. You choose, you take 10 photos and then choose the one that you want to use. You choose the hashtags. You know, it's really giving you permission to be that person and be seen like how you want to be seen. Right. I don't want to give too much value to sort of Yeah, I mean, because at the end of the day, you know, having 100,000 followers or 10 million followers or whatever doesn't, you know, pay the rent or pay the bills. And it also becomes a little bit of a sort of digital zoo, as Alok Vaidmenon talks about. But yeah, I think that, you know, any technology can be used for good and evil. And I think that when thinking about sort of selfie culture and kind of the online bits, there's both, right? So it's sort of both and it's right. It's, it can be used as a digital zoo, but that it can also be used as a space for, you know, presenting yourself on your own terms and kind of trying to find community and outreach, you know, like without social media, how would people reach out to me as instantly as they have been now since the book come out? Do you know what I mean? Like that's for me, one clear example, people have decided to send me selfies with the book. And that's a way of also creating a connection. Do you know?
Yeah. It's an extension of your writing. Actually, I would argue it's an extension of the book itself, and that you begin writing with and through other people, writing writing through their looks, essentially. Although it's problematic when people overly invest in their life, you know, online, so to speak, it is a domain that cannot be discounted. And also it makes us think about the power of surfaces and appearance, and that essentially, you know, the world is visual. We have eyes. So when we're even in real space, in space with real bodies, it's still a question of the visual. And the screen just draws our attention to that more. You quote critic Virginia Pastrell saying, quote, "Our real selves are the ones wearing makeup and high heels. We care about surfaces," end quote. And I think that's crucial. We're talking about the surface of the body. First of all, you know, that you're adorning the surface of the body. So there's a substance there already and is inseparable. But what does that mean that our real selves are the ones wearing makeup and high heels?
I think it's, you know, I think it's about allowing yourself to have permission to be, you know, because of things like, sexism and misogyny and trans misogyny and racism, you know, if you choose to present your, you know, I think that we make subtle choices every day to present ourselves in ways so that we can like survive and or be safe. I think that this is something that most people kind of think about. I think that where the fabulousness kicks in is when you decide to be you on your own terms despite the worlds that you circulate in or have to circulate in, and even though that might not be valued in those spaces, you know. So I think that's for me what it is. It's about choosing to do you despite the fact that, you know, the spaces that you're circulating in are not necessarily made for you. Do you know what, like?
Yeah, right, exactly. And it is sort of adopting the minoritizing rhetoric assigned to marginalized people, but like living through that rhetoric in a way that tests others' fears. So the fabulous person who may be called sick or even physically harassed is saying through their fabulousness, "I'll show you what sick looks like. I'll show you how to slay."
You know, I'll show you. It is that sort of, you know, snatching back of, you know, that language visually and through style, right. You know. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a visual snatch.
Yeah.
Is the fabulous interchange that responds to the oppression. But also in a sort of all-embracing way, like he says, well, if you can be a part of this, if you want, you're choosing not to, and you're not going to tell, you know, you're not going to hinder this part of myself, and I'll give you back what you gave me, but in a way that shows exploits essentially your own denigration of me to my own use and joy.
Yes. No, it's like, you think I'm sick. Well, I'm actually sickening, and it's not my fault that you choose boredom, you know?
Exactly.
You know? And so like, that's the, for me, like that's what I would love for folks to the place that I would like for people love for people to get to, you know. I can't tell you yeah, how many times I have had to police, you know, over, I do it less now. But it also, even the fact that like, even that I'm hyper aware of these systems and how they work, that even I still feel policed to kind of conform is like annoying and is the kind of thing that I would like to burst through. But it also shows you how powerful these kind of systems are. And when I was speaking to someone yesterday or the other day about like, you know, sort of kind of, yeah, embracing their body as they are, and that it's, you know, that, you know, if you want to wear heels, you should, or if you want to be however you want, it's fine. But that, you know, that fear you have pre-exists you even being born. Like it's like hundreds of years of like systems of normativity that have been like beat into the culture, so that when you're born, right, you know, it's like, of course you have fear. And because you've been in social worlds that have taught you that you should be afraid to be this way. But the hard work is unlearning that fear, and that it's not like a like, oh, today, haha, I've discovered the secret and now I'm not afraid. You know, it's like, actually, it's a process and it's a to and a fro. And some days you might feel like you want to absolutely slay, but then other days you might feel like you can't, because you've just had enough of being, you know, a feeling afraid, or you just want to just go get the sandwich. You know, you don't, right, want to be bothered actually at all.
Right. It's the same with coming out. You know, people think that coming out as gay or, yes, bisexual or whatever is a one-time event, and then you're out, and before you were in. But it's a constant negotiation of different spaces and expectations of people. And so you're always going to be feeling the potential, if not the reality, of pressure. Mm-hmm. To make decisions on whether to say or do something in a particular, ooh, situation. And I mean, yes, we can see this as like, well, we're not fully liberated, or which is true, but that's an ideal that is probably impossible and negates the fact that life is full of, yes, of trauma in all sorts of ways, yes, that have to do with all sorts of things. And so to be aware, though, that some days you don't have the energy for a certain kind of expression, or even that in some moments you feel like you're closeted or can't be fabulous, that to be aware of that is what's actually necessary in order to then be fabulous at some other time.
Yeah.
That they both kind of work together, these energies.
And I think it's also important to sort of say that, you know, I think that when people do fabulousness, it's often not even, I mean, it's not even or ever for other people, it's for you. So sometimes what I have issue, you know, with is when people are like, oh my God, yes, you look amazing, yeah, whatever. And it's like, sometimes I don't need to be acknowledged, or I, you know, it's like I do this, or we do this, or people do this because it's how we feel and it's how we want to be. It's not about like always, right, about being sort of, yeah, the capturable moment for your camera phone. Do you know what I mean? Or,
yeah, right. Yeah. There's a burden. There's an extra burden on people who are more visually fabulous,
yes,
to carry the weight of for others.
Yes.
They stand in as that special person who can be special and that we can celebrate as special.
And also,
but yeah, this is extra burden.
And also to be entertainment, really, you know, it's,
right,
about, it's,
yeah,
about your sort of like entertainment. So, oh my God, yes. You know, like, yes, queen, ow. And it's like, okay, calm down. but yeah, I think that it's, there's a lot of layers to it.
Yeah, and in some ways that like seeing someone as the special token expression of fabulousness just kind of reinforces the norms, right? It just sort of keeps the difference in place, this us versus them. Where, mm-hmm, where you talk about how you say that fabulousness is the power to abstract,
yes,
norms, you know,
yes,
so you play with the word sick, you play with the word slay, this is verbal, this is visual, this is auditory,
mm-hmm,
and to abstract norms, it's not to show things are not so clear cut as our conceptual understandings might make them, you know, out to be, but to abstract norms to me sort of resonates with the world of art actually, and what, mm-hmm, art does. So and you have many examples and interviews with people in the book who are also in the contemporary art world, vocalists, performers, designers.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you find the connection between, you know, in this moment in time, across the world, really, how fabulousness and beautiful eccentricity ties in with the art world and in the contemporary art scene, and where do they come together and what do they do for each other, if not this being the same thing?
Well, I think that this is super, you know, layered and complex. Firstly, because when you look at kind of queer art and performance, a lot of it emerges not necessarily in and even art and even, you know, pieces are not necessarily meant or destined for like the kind of imperial contemporary art gallery space, but rather emerge in nightclubs and in bars and pubs and really venues and spaces that are at the fringes. And that's because, you know, oftentimes these cultural institutions, these art institutions don't know or have language for making sense of the work that's happening on the fringes.
Right.
And so, you know, artists are forced, you know, to kind of find and even thrive in, you know, finding spaces elsewhere. So I think that what you're seeing a lot of at the moment in terms of the art world is museums, major museums and spaces that are drawing on kind of trends of queer nightlife and like bringing these bodies and spaces and communities and, you know, collectives into their spaces in a lot of ways to make them seem relevant again. and so, you know, for instance, last year there was an exhibition at Tate Britain. It was queer British art from like 1867 to I think 1967 or four or something like this. And the exhibition was, you know, yeah, a history of homosexuality in the UK, basically. Mm-hmm. But what they didn't really do is include works by women and people of color, especially. So around as a way around that, they programmed a whole series of kind of events around nightlife and kind of queer collectives in London, queer color collectives in London that are creating space and art in nightlife. They basically parachuted them into the Tate Britain to kind of, fill the gaps that they had curatorially in the show. So I think that, like, on the one hand, for me, like, everything that's interesting pop culture-wise or aesthetically is happening in nightclubs or these venues at the fringes, these pop-up theater spaces, these fringe, you know, like a friend of mine has basically a sort of loft or sort of apartment that he uses to stage art events and like queer fringe performance. You know, it's things like this that where people go to create community that then kind of eventually find their way into the mainstream kind of art spaces. And I say this just to say that it's happening. You know, I think it's a tricky topic. Yeah. But I say it just to say that it's definitely happening. I prefer like queer art and performance sort of that's still on the fringes.
And also that it is, there are institutional politics as there are in so many art forms that is that makes it difficult for certain forms of expression, especially highly politicized ones and ones politicized in very personal ways, to show up in traditional gallery spaces, but also the very nature of fabulousness as ephemeral and sort of the moment, poses a particular challenge, I guess, to capture in an exhibit, about, you know, something such as fabulousness. Mm-hmm. But I, beyond that, and as you also suggest, there is nonetheless a connection between artistic practice in general and being fabulous. Go ahead.
I mean, I think this is one of my major kind of aims in the book is to show that it's like, you know, if you look at folks like Lee Bowery, you know, and if you look at folks like in London, an amazing kind of club kid called Doc Demure, like these people are performance artists. Doc Demure is like a DJ and a party host, and he is an amazing example of a kind of film noir, I don't know, personality, drag queen, I don't know. But basically they are, you know, completely, they paint themselves like silver. So I don't think I've ever, but silver and even oftentimes like white. And it's, you know, I think that's like, for me, that Dr. Muir is like a prime example of like, you know, the kind of aesthetic genius that goes into creating yourself or to creating a look and to constantly imagine something new every day or whenever you want to do it, you know? And I think that's what I was also trying to do in the book, is really think about fabulousness, not as something that is, you know, not something that's only kind of Hollywood glamour and kind of, you know, Beyonce level or, you know, pop star level or whatever. I mean, I think I tried very hard. I think, okay, so when I was initially doing the book and the dissertation, I was more interested in kind of like celebrities and kind of glamour and these big worlds. But then I realized actually, and this is because I was at the time of doing the dissertation and being in Yale, I also worked in the art world in New York and in sort of magazines and these kind of spaces. And I didn't know at the time that like, I think I was going through my orals or whatever, so third year, and I didn't know that like my working at Interview magazine was going to somehow end up in the book or that it would be that. I just wanted to do it because I liked it, you know?
Right.
And I felt like I need to sort of be in these kind of, pop culture worlds in New York. I just wanted to be where the thick of it was. So I didn't know that it was going to shape my worldview in ways. And it did, because I realized that actually, you know, I worked on so many photo shoots and I realized, oh, actually there's a whole apparatus behind this. So like, you know, when Oprah or whomever appears on the cover of a magazine, there are countless interns and photo assistants and editors and PR agents and messengers involved in a single photo shoot. So it's actually like an entire apparatus, you know, and I was able to something happened basically, and it was great for me to be doing coursework and orals at the same time that I was working in these spaces, because it made me really connect the dots between the theory and the everyday of like how these industries actually work.
Right.
And so I made the choice where I was like, actually, do you know what? Like, I don't want to write about celebrities because they have an entire machine. Of course they're fabulous. They have like, they get free gowns from like Dior, of course, you know? And so I was like, well, that's actually not that interesting. And it was in working in those worlds that I realized that. So that's when I made the choice that actually I'm interested in folks in the club worlds and people who don't have access to those systems, but do it on their own term, but do it on their own. Right. And so often they are students at Central St. Martin's and they're at Parsons and they're at kind of, you know, RISD, and they're at these art schools, and they are just really creative and bursting with ideas and aesthetic energy. And they, create themselves anew because they have to, and it's a need. And so for me, that was thinking about people doing fabulousness as artists and as aesthetic geniuses and as creative powerhouses and kind of innovators was way more interesting for me than like the celebrity who gets to wear Alexander McQueen because, you know, they have a, you know, deal with KCD PR agency.
No, I completely agree that it is ultimately uninteresting, the process of being fabulous as a celebrity, whereas the process of being fabulous, the expression among other people, is not only more interesting, but is where the aesthetic value, the ethics actually lie.
Yes. And
so you talk about, obviously, a few times now, the club as this crucial,
Sorry about that.
tell me about the club and why it's integral to understanding this nexus of fabulosity.
So this is a huge one for me. I don't know where to start. For me, the club always represented a space. I've always been like a club person. So even when I was, you know, in Ferguson, Missouri, my cousin, she's younger than me, but she had a driver's license and a car and I didn't. So I would call her up and be like, girl, take me to the club, please. Can we just go? Because I couldn't get there otherwise. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was about, you know, finding community and being in a space that was kind of alive and thumping. And I think as I've gotten older and been to different clubs and different places and different cities and at different ages, you know, I see like the vitality they have, not only for people who are, seeking community, but then also for when you think about drag queens and party people and club kids and also DJs, you know, there are so many ideas that emerge and that are birthed in nightclubs. Whether it's, you know, say you're at a bar and you're a graphic design student at St. Martin's or Parsons, and you end up talking to someone who has a cool project they're working on or they want to work on, and somehow you end up working together, you know, on a thing. So basically, like, seeing the clubs less as, or also as spaces of entertainment and fun and kind of hedonism, but also as a space that is an incubator for ideas and that generate other possibilities, not only in terms of like the art itself, but even in you. Like, there's so many people that I know who, including myself, who sort of embraced DJing and became DJs because they were like going to clubs, you know, or, you know, yeah. So I think this is a huge one for me, but basically I think that clubs are spaces of queer world making, and they're spaces of community, and they're spaces of kind of music and electricity. And I'm skeptical of terms like safe space, but I think that they allow at least a portal to another dimension, at least temporarily, for, you know, it's, you know, a couple of hours, or if you're in Berlin, up to 56 hours, that you can sort of, yeah, play and have a bit of a break from the everyday and a little bit of a break from the norms that are oppressing you, and whatever your social situation is.
Right. So I'm just thinking, you know, what is it about the club that allows for these ideas to be generated and shared? And you're saying it's the playfulness, it's the letting go, and it's just being around people who want to be sharing themselves with others.
Yeah, I think it's you wanting to share, but also, I mean, you go out. I mean, you're in a good mood, right? I think.
Okay. Right. So, yeah, like, it's the joy. And, pleasure. It's
joy. Yeah. You're with your friends and you're there. I don't want to be monolithic. I think people maybe go out and maybe they're not in a great mood, but I think in general, if you go out, like, maybe you're in a good mood. And so you're more open to possibilities and connecting with people in ways that you wouldn't, or that maybe seem faux pas on a day-to-day basis, like 9 to 5 or whatever, do you know?
Right. But now we have to talk about the question of getting into the club, because you spend many pages. Well, actually, you frame the chapter on the club in terms of standing in line waiting. And I must say, it was a little bit anxiety producing for me and maybe for others. Like, would I get in? And now you actually turn that question on its head and say, well, getting in is not a question of exclusion based on like a decided status beforehand. You know, it's not the minoritizing logic that brings people that people go to the club to escape. It's actually what you call curation, that the club is curating the experience. But still, it seems to me that there is a question of and real anxiety about whether you would get in or not. So what is the place of the line and standing in line and being chosen by the door person? Or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a couple of things at stake here. Of course, you know, door policies are exclusionary, and they're going to, it's, you know, people get in or they don't, and that is that's a discriminatory practice just on its own. So acknowledging that, and also acknowledging that, like, you know, it is generally used, door policies are generally used to police or protect whiteness. So to keep, you know, black, brown bodies out, you know, there are so many clubs and parties in, you know, I think you see less of this sort of in the UK, but definitely, like, I've seen in spaces in the US where they might have a lineup, like a thing outside that says, you know, no backward hats, no tank tops, no whatever, da-da-da. Basically, like, no black people is what they're saying. And this sort of very coded language that's, you know, kind of around style or, like, fashion items. So, yeah, I would say that my interest in door policies came... I was writing about Studio 54 because I was very interested in... just the kind of hype machine around it, and, you know, not necessarily, how do I say this? Yeah, I guess the question for me was, why are people so desperate to get into this space? you know, and so what I tried to do in that chapter is really think about the line as like something that, Studio 54, you know, didn't invent. They didn't invent sort of the, you know, velvet robe, and they didn't invent the kind of tight door policy where people are excluded or not allowed entry based on arbitrary kind of factors. This was already happening, you know, in the Harlem Renaissance. It was already happening in different club spaces throughout time, which I found fascinating. And so for me, I think the interest was like, okay, what is it about human nature, about like that we want to be in spaces where it's hard to get in? And I think I tried to look at that. So when I discovered there are certain kinds of clubs in New York, for instance, where it's all about kind of glamour and, you know, kind of financial capital and money in certain ways in certain spaces, where, you know, you might not get in because you don't have the right sort of shoe on or whatever, or you don't look expensive enough, basically, right, is what I'm saying, or you don't look beautiful enough. And so when I got to Berlin and I discovered that actually most clubs prefer people who seem more alternative, like, that for me was really interesting because I didn't know that before, and I didn't it was unusual to me, basically, to see, like, basically the people who would be kind of having express entry to clubs in New York City, for instance, are precisely those who are turned away in Berlin, yeah, in Berlin, right, clubs, which I found fascinating. And so, yeah, I think for me, like, it is, when you think about the kind of, policies that privilege people who are more alternative or more maybe marginalized or more less, you know, or less mainstream, for me, that is really about, you know, giving space to, yeah, I don't know. It's about like saying no to the mainstream.
Right. No, it's a smart distinction. It's hard to sort of show and demonstrate, but I think you do it very well in the chapter. At least you communicate that there are differences in exclusionary practices. And obviously someone could say, well, letting in the people who wouldn't get let in another club, that's reverse racism. But of course, anyone who says reverse, accuse you of reverse racism.
Well, it's not a thing.
Right. Well, that's, yeah. Exactly. But also, it's just to say that they're not able to tap into something about themselves that others are. I mean, it seems to me to be they're just complaining about themselves, for, you know, and that there is something to be said about people who, though it's risky, and who are able to be fabulous.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something, you know, it's like, I don't.
We all have the potential, and that's what I'm saying. We all have the potential. So it's not like it's really exclusionary. But are you able to go there? Are you able to get there? Are you able to wear that spiky shoe?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, you know, I think that like social spaces. I mean, I use the term, you know, that these spaces are kind of curated and sculpted a certain way, and it's like basically once you get inside, you are like participating in. On the one hand, I mean, it's also branding, of course, you know, so you're also like participating in the kind of fantasy that the particular club wants to convey and have of itself. You know, so door policies also are technologies that facilitate that. But I think, you know, often, you know, in London, let's say, for instance, like door policy is not really a thing. So, and I'm not sure if it's like a legal thing, if you're not allowed to do it, even kind of in New York club history, it was, people sued 54 because, of its door policy, saying that it was exclusionary, you know, basically. But there have been times when I've kind of been to parties here where I'm like, I just wish there were more of this kind of person, or I wish that it was more like this. Right. And, you know, that's about yearning for community and people who are like more like-minded. So yeah, I don't know, maybe it's controversial, yeah. But I think it is about curating that space, you know?
Yeah, it's inescapably controversial, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. And being around people who are like you is a question of the visual. It's a question of curating the visual. And also it just points up to the fact that normativity or people who conform to the norms, they're wearing a costume just as much as anybody else, except their costume is completely uninteresting. Their charade is failing. That's the point.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you say that, right? Because that's for me also, the example that I was thinking in my head just now is like, you know, one of my worst nightmares would be to be like in a, you know, right, like a pub with like, you know, a bunch of really bro-y, you know, guys. Like, to me, that sounds, I exclude myself from that situation, you know, because I don't want to be there. But for them, that's like, that's what they want. And that's great. I prefer to be in like other kind of spaces. And I think it's important to talk about when you think about door policy that people, when you choose where to go at night, you're already pre-selecting yourself also. Exactly. At that point, because you're like, oh, well, I don't go to heaven because heaven is like this. And I don't go to that club because this club is like that. So you're already
pre-selecting
yourself before you get there.
Discrimination happens all the time. And that's just how we get through the day. In the choices that we make. So we only have a minute left, but I just wanted to ask you where you were going next. What's your next project or what are you thinking about?
Well, on this topic, the next book is called How to Go Clubbing. And it's a book about precisely about club culture. It is going to be out on Yale Press. And I'm also working on a performance, an immersive performance lecture that's also about club culture.
That's great.
So for me, I see the projects as united. So on the one hand, you know, the book, the study about club culture and the value of pleasure and not being afraid of pleasure. And then kind of an immersive lecture that's about kind of club culture that draws on sound and image and DJing and kind of, you know, that's the piece.
Yeah. That's wonderful. I mean, to extend it to even lecturing or, you know, quote unquote lecturing or communicating about the book, that there, the lecturing and communication, it can be as, you know, performative as anything and should be really an extension of the book, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and this is something that I, you know, definitely owe to other innovative performance scholar artists like Kareem Khoomchamdani, E. Patrick Johnson, who are also, you know, doing work around not only the kind of written work, but also bringing it into performance.
And now you're part of that group. So we want to thank Madison Moore for joining us today on this episode of New Books in American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. The book is called Fabulous, The Rise of the Beautiful Eccentric, and it's out now from Yale University Press. Madison, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.